I see Dennis has arrived, and his presentation will be about Liberace, and it's entitled Liberace, Entertainer at the Piano. Dennis Rooney has been a frequent presenter at the ARS conferences and workshops and has been a member of ARS Technical Committee since 1996, and he has reviewed books and recordings for the ARS Journal. He regularly contributes features and reviews to the Strad and is an occasional contributor to the BBC Music Magazine, Classic Record Collector, American Record Guide, and MusicalAmerica.com. Everybody have their .coms ready? An audio producer specializing in historic reissues. He was a series consultant to Sony's Classical Masterworks Heritage line and produced many other reissues for the label. He is also an archives and catalog exploitation consultant to the record industry. I give you Dennis Rooney.
Reggio Valentino Liberace was born in West Allis, Wisconsin on the 16th of May, 1919. He was the third child and second son of Francis and Salvatore Liberace. His mother was Polish. His father, known as Sam, was a Neapolitan immigrant who was an occasional horn player. Reggio, whose twin brother was stillborn, emerged under the call, which portended great deeds and good fortune. He showed musical talent young, which his father nurtured, at first teaching the boy himself, and then arranging teachers, the most important of whom was Florence Kelly, who taught him from the late 1920s to his debut with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Frederick Stock, in Milwaukee's Pabst Theater in 1940. By then, he was known as Walter, or Wally. His pianism began earning money for the family when he played for silent films. His reputation brought him dates with local bands, and he adopted the professional name of Walter Buster Keys. He trained for a concert career, but in his teens showed great interest in popular music. Kelly encouraged this, and after he played the Liszt A Major Concerto with the Chicago Symphony, suggested it was time to try his luck in New York. Although he struggled for a while, by 1941, he began landing jobs in hotels and nightclubs in the metropolitan area. When World War II began, his elder brother George joined the Navy as a Seabee, but Lee, as he was increasingly known, had a cyst on his spine that exempted him from military service. During the war, he moved to California. By 1947, He had an agent and was enjoying better and better engagements. He made his first recordings for such small labels as Souvenir, Signature, Sonora, and Daytone. At the same time, his name was phonetically spelled on publicity photos and banners. He got his first engagement in the fledgling Sin City of Las Vegas at the Last Frontier Club in 1944. It was a perfect fit. His next engagement always paid better than his last. He began appearing in variety shows on local television in Los Angeles. In 1950, he played at the White House Press Photographer's Ball, where he was noticed by an executive of Universal Studios. The result was his movie debut in South Sea Sinners with Shelley Winters. In those years, Liberace often traveled by train from one coast to the other to play engagements in such hotels as New York's Plaza. By 1951, he had appeared on Piano Playhouse, a weekly ABC sustaining program, and this excerpt is perhaps the earliest surviving document of his live performance.
Quite a few months ago, we presented a handsome young man who has been described as dynamic, terrific, sensational, plus a great many more descriptive adjectives. This young man has just returned from a tour of America where he has played to standing room only at every engagement. We're happy to present once again the dynamic Liberace. Certainly nice to have you back on the program this morning, Liberace.
Thank you very much.
I've heard some glowing reports about your countrywide tour.
Well, thank you again. The only reason I'm in New York, of course, is to do the Piano Playhouse. And then on Tuesday night, I'm making my first appearance on Milton Berle's television show.
So I understand. What are you going to play for us this morning?
Well, I'd like to do some Irving Berlin, some of the show tunes from his great Broadway hit, Call Me Madam.
Fine. Liberace, on his way to the piano to play for us a medley from Call Me Madam. Thank you.
In February 1952, Liberace appeared on his own television program on KLAC in Los Angeles. It was 15 minutes long, and he received $1,000. Already you can see his candelabrum. That's candelabrum one for you people ignorant of Latin plurals. Anyway, 1 month later, he signed with Columbia Records. His first releases reprised some of what he had recorded earlier, at first on 78s and 45s, but soon, with its illustrated covers, the LP would become dominant. Popular from the start, the television program's increasing audiences led to his choice by NBC as the summer replacement for Dinah Shore in July. In that same month, he packed the Hollywood Bowl when 20,000 people bought tickets to hear him, a feat never repeated in that venue. But his television popularity really took off 1 year later, after his television debut, when he signed with Guild Films for 177 half-hour episodes. By 1954, his Columbia record sales had topped 400,000. His popularity began to attract unfavorable attention from critics of music and the media, especially Howard Taubman in the New York Times and the television critic John Crosby. The latter's jabs at Liberace inspired Al Capp, creator of the immensely popular cartoon strip Little Abner, to create the characters of Don Crabsby and Lover Boynick, the latter a spoof of Liberace, but drawn to resemble the wrestler Gorgeous George. It ran during much of 1954. In 1955, his program was carried by 180 stations nationwide, and in that same year, he was a guest on The Ed Sullivan Show and named by the Guinness Book of World Records as the highest paid entertainer in the world. The next year, he appeared on Edward R. Murrow's Person to Person. In 1956, he went to London for a command performance before Queen Elizabeth. The year before, he had starred in the Warner Brothers feature Sincerely Yours, but it had failed at the box office. While in London, he was attacked in the Daily Mirror by Cassandra, the nom de plume of critic William Connor. It was the most provocative suggestion yet, however indirect, of Liberace's homosexuality. After consideration, he decided to sue. It took 3 years, but he was eventually vindicated in a London courtroom on the 18th of June, 1959, and Connor in the Daily Mirror had to pay him $22,000 plus court costs. Oh, this went away. No, I'm sorry. On November 23rd, 1963, while the world was distracted by the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Liberace was admitted to a Pittsburgh hospital with renal failure, brought on by carbon tetrachloride poisoning when cleaning his own costumes in an unventilated space. He wasn't expected to live, but somehow recovered and considered it a miracle. For the rest of his life, his shows always had the first four rows reserved for nuns. In 1964, he appeared in Tony Richardson's film, The Loved One, as Mr. Starker, the casket salesman. Those events occurred during a career decline Liberace experienced from 1958 to 65. After that, his career recovered until his earnings returned and then exceeded their earlier level. By the late 60s, he had long since discarded the full dress of his earlier television and personal appearances in favor of a series of ever more elaborate costumes. He loved fancy dress, as reflected in the matching sheared beaver outfits he and his mother wore in this photo. Frances Liberace, until her death in 1981, remained an incalculable influence on her second son. By this time, classical music had almost vanished in favor of arrangements of all kinds of material in ever more elaborate shows. The earlier debate over his pianistic abilities had faded as the entertainer took, if you will, center stage, as in this little bicentennial number, and its animated version, unfortunately, not in color. So how well did Liberace actually play? The answer is quite well. His natural musical gifts had been excellently trained. He possessed exceptional fluency, produced a consistently beautiful tone on any instrument he played, mostly Baldwin's, by the way, and had a keen stylistic awareness. Here is an excerpt from Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu. In many ways, it's admirable. Noticed is doubtless what Liberace himself understood about his gifts. The phrasing lacks the tonal excitement and eloquence that are hallmarks of great Chopin playing, and he knew he would not be able to build a conventional concert career on that level of playing. He determined, therefore, to choose a different path, and he devoted the rest of his life to creating a way to entertain audiences through music. Often as at great physical cost, as Dan Langan, who was his press agent in the 1980s, remembered.
Anyone work as hard in a nightclub as Liberace did. And I have some background on that because I reviewed club acts for the Syracuse Post-Standard and for Variety. But it was just amazing the way that he would prowl around the stage, that he would sing, he would play piano, he would dance, he would chat with the audience, and he was very animated when he was doing that. And if you consider that the robe or whatever costume he was wearing weighed well over 50 pounds, then you have to give him extra credit. The only one I ever saw come close to him was Jimmy Durante, who would sing, who would dance, and then who would roughhouse it and pick up the top of the upright piano and hurl it across the stage of Jack Roth, his drummer. But Lee was the champion. I remember one night when I had to see him at intermission in his dressing room because I had to relay a request from a very important member of the press. And I walked in, and there he is wearing a terry cloth robe and just dabbing away at the perspiration that was streaming down his face, down his back. That's how hard he worked.
This medley from a Las Vegas appearance is a quintessential Liberace performance. Like the best improvisers, he has calculated the elements precisely and combines disparate material in novel ways. The great French organists would have recognized a fellow sensibility. There it is. Thank you. Stephen Sondheim, in his wildest dreams, could never imagine having sent in the clowns clothed in the Rachmaninovian vestments that Liberace gives him, nor to have segued into Vesti la Giuba. That is mastery. Liberace, who long ago had shed all of his other names but that, died on the 4th of February, 1987. The museum and the foundation that bore his name did not long survive his demise. Fortunately, recordings do survive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I can still remember the Spike Jones act where I think it was I'm in the Mood for Love and a miniature piano with a little bit of Billy Barney. Yeah, I was mouthing the lyrics to the song and a little candelabra on the piano. And then in what, Mr. Sandman, they mentioned lots of wavy hair like Liberace.
Yeah.
And Hey Liberace song. Mike.
In the mid-70s, my parents dragged me kicking and screaming to a Liberace performance at the Jersey Fest Fine Arts Center outdoor. It was magnificent. Mm-hmm. It just escalated. He had the power to just bring everybody with him faster and faster as he went changing costumes near the end. Everybody was on their feet screaming and standing on their chairs.
Just like a Kiss concert.
It was absolutely, the energy of that concert was absolutely amazing. This is an outdoor, so it would be dissipated, but it was magnificent.
And unlike a Kiss concert, it was about music, not noise.
But it was about costumes.
Yeah, can't argue with that. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your attention.